Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And so, lots of Russians are perfectly okay with the war, and the war is not affecting them necessarily in a negative way. And although the death numbers are high, the demography of who is dying, i.e. the poorer people, the people who don't have as much voice, bluntly the people who, if we can talk of a Russian middle class, the Russian middle class don't really care about, the people who are dying, they're not just they are not viewed as important, but also the numbers of those dying ultimately aren't balancing out the number of people who are kind of all right with the war or doing okay out of it. You know, a lot of, there's new elites forming, there's new ways to make money. You know, you can buy, provided you don't mind stepping over the corpses on the threshold of the doorway, you can buy a nice new flat near the sea in Mariupol or Berdyansk. That's where we are. And I think the consistent refusal, one of the things that frustrates me is, as somebody who would like to see a different Russia, if only for Ukraine's sake, is the consistent refusal to engage with the utter moral catastrophe that is happening in Russia.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Behind the Lines. Kharkiv is Ukraine's second city, a city of over 1.5 million people, and it's currently under intense bombardment by Russian missiles. It has almost no air defence, and it has seen incredible destruction. Its infrastructure, schools, housing, all devastated by these attacks. But its will to resist is something remarkable. And I had the extraordinary opportunity to speak to Dr. Jade McGlynn, who is a British academic, an expert on Ukraine and Russia, and is currently based in Kharkiv. So this is really a frontline perspective on what's going on there. Now, I know that some of you were expecting the second part of my interview with Sidney Nash on Britain's relationship with Europe. I promise you that episode is coming, but with the opportunity to have an up-to-the-minute insight from Jade, who's there on the ground in Kharkiv, witnessing what's happening in that conflict, it seemed silly not to share that with you immediately. So here's Jade. I hope you find it as fascinating as I did.
Hello, I'm Jade McGlynn. I'm a research fellow at King's College London. My work has focused since 2014 on Russia's war in Ukraine. In particular, I suppose, the identity and ideational aspects of it, and I currently split my time between the UK and Ukraine, where I am now.
Yeah, so we were just talking before I started the recording, Jade. Could you say where exactly, which city you're in at least, and what's the current situation there? Because it's really quite dramatic, in fact.
Yeah, I'm currently in Kharkiv, which is where I live when I'm here in Ukraine. And yeah, the situation is quite dramatic. I think I described it as noisy, perhaps using some British understatement. I currently have electricity, but I don't have hot water. I hope we have gas for cooking because we didn't yesterday. Normally, if you have electricity, you don't have hot water. If you have hot water, you don't have electricity. So you can't, you can't be greedy and have both. But of course, that's as a result of the massive infrastructure attacks that Russia has been targeting across Ukraine, but especially at Kharkiv. They've also been making efforts to take out like television communications. So there was an attack on the Ukrainian on the Kharkiv television tower just yesterday, I believe, if my memory serves me correctly. And that's been part of an overall effort that's also been happening in Sumy region and Chernihiv, also in the north, but further west. To take out Ukrainian television so that the Russians can put their propaganda on the television. However, it doesn't work like they think it would, because most Ukrainians don't use television for news consumption, and certainly nowhere near the same numbers as is the case in Russia.
Jade, I don't know if you can hear me. I can't hear
you. Yeah, you know. I can hear you now.
Oh, you've come back. So I guess I was going to ask, and that was right on cue, was how about internet? That's obviously a bit patchy.
Yeah, the internet's quite patchy. Sometimes I just give up replying to people. So if anybody's listening and I haven't replied to your messages, it's just out of frustration. It's not because I don't like you. And also sometimes it's just, for example, my friend called me sort of 9 times and I just didn't, I could see them calling me and I just wasn't getting the calls. So there's lots going on there, particularly across the Kyivstar network. In general, the city is under a huge attack from Russia, which has never given up its aim of either destroying or taking Kharkiv or turning it into a grey zone, which is their horribly euphemistic term for essentially destroying it, making it uninhabitable. And some of the conditions that I've described, they're all part of those efforts to depopulate Kharkiv. I have to say, it's not working. A lot of people in Kharkiv have been here, through much worse days. And lots of people also have come from other parts of Kharkiv region, or indeed from neighboring Donetsk region, from parts that were under occupation, some of them, since 2014. And so there's this real sense in the city that we go no further. We've come here, but that's it. Like, this city stands. You're not taking this city. And it's worth remembering that when they tried to take it last time, they had an infinitely better army, infinitely better sort of trained, for example, desantniki, parachutists. They were essentially all wiped out by Kraken Special, well, what would become Kraken Special Division, of course, the Ukrainian army, but also just plucky, civilian trained, but civilian defense forces. So how they're planning on doing it with, a slightly repaired, but still much weaker army, it doesn't seem clear, though they are constantly threatening it. They do appear to have men now sort of being grouped in Belgorod region, just over the border, about 25 kilometers away from here. But the numbers that they have are not anywhere near the sort of numbers. I think probably they would need around 850,000 men if they wanted to truly try to take Kharkiv, and they don't have those numbers at all.
A lot of people who are internally displaced within Ukraine, is that right?
Kharkiv is, of course, Ukraine's second largest city. And so often walking around the city, because of this new influx of residents, you don't necessarily feel, the city doesn't feel deserted. Of course, it doesn't feel like it was before 2022. But that's also partly because around a quarter of the city is just destroyed.
Let's situate that a bit in the wider context of Ukraine. Now, obviously, geographically, I'm sure most listeners are well aware of, Kharkiv is very close to the Russian border. It's a sort of unfortunate that it finds itself in that place. But in the wider battle that is happening,
Of course, Russia has managed to sort of seize the initiative to a certain extent, both with its devastating attacks on infrastructure in Kharkiv and elsewhere, but also on the situation in the ground. What's your sense of where that's going at the moment?
I think in a way, Russia was given the initiative by those who decided to play silly domestic politics with the aid that should have gone to Ukraine. But I take your point. I think the trajectory up until now, over the last, let's say, 4 or 5 months, has been definitively a negative one. I found during my trips back to the UK the complacency sometimes, not so much in Whitehall, but more among politicians, of the complacency that, oh, you know, it's fine. Once Ukraine wins, then we'll do. You think, oh, hang on a minute, how do we get to the point where Ukraine wins?
Yeah,
I'd love to know. I'd really love to know for my friends, you know, for some of the people whom I love who are fighting. So please, please do fill me in on this secret magic recipe where we get to when Ukraine wins. And this idea that the Russians are just, you know, a spent force, or that they're all idiots, or that, you know, essentially you're talking about these barbaric hordes. It's firstly, I find there's always slightly racist undertones to it. But secondly, it's just incredibly disrespectful. I remember I was speaking not too long ago to the commander of 32nd Brigade, who's responsible for stopping the Russians from taking the administrative borders of Luhansk and Donetsk region. So pretty tough job. He's a pretty tough guy. And he was just so enraged when somebody basically suggested to him, somebody in our group from the West, suggested to him that, you know, the Russians, like, you know, they just like throw like untrained men, and, you know, they're not properly equipped. And he was just so angry because it's such a way of, it really underestimates the sacrifices. And, you know, of course the Russians are a proper army. Yeah, they use human waves of meat storms. I'm not sure how it's translated into English. In Russian, it's meat storm, which is a very unpleasant turn of phrase. Of course they do, but then they're the first few waves, and then after them they have, you know, proper chain cadres. We saw in Avdiivka that Russian troops have learned how to adapt. This idea that we'll just wait and the Russians will collapse is complete wishful thinking, and Ukraine needs a lot more support. And I don't just mean money, I mean it needs a lot more support across a different range of issues. But in order for its allies to be able to provide that support, there needs to be, I think, needs to be a lot more understanding of what is actually happening here. I'm always surprised, you know, for example, by just the sheer lack of Americans, American officials who are able, basically none of whom go east of Kyiv.
Yeah.
It's just generally informal policy, you know, unofficial policy. You don't go east of Kyiv. I'm sure, as always, there are some cheeky Americans who break the rules. But how on earth are you supposed to understand what's going on if you're in Lviv or like the fanciest restaurants in Kyiv?
Yeah, because in fact, what you get a lot of is people visiting Kyiv, which I've also done, but and then saying it's remarkable. It's like another European city. And you think, well, that's not the point, is it? You know, that's not where the war's taking place.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and Kyiv is so defended. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love Kyiv, and I think it's helpful. You know, I mean, not everybody, you know, I very, very rarely go close to the front line because what use am I there? But it's also just about, you know, the war is felt very differently in different parts and in different parts of the country. And you do need to travel about, and you do as well need to speak to people, because there's a tendency among, I don't wish to seem critical of Ukrainians, but there is a tendency among some Ukrainians to, you know, understandably, to wage an information war that, you know, is consistently sort of upbeat and, oh yeah, we can do this, we can do that. But for me as an analyst, you know, my job isn't, and I understand why they do that, so it's not a criticism, because they're doing it for the survival of their country. But for me as an analyst, actually, I need to understand what's really going on, because then it's easier to work out what support is actually needed. And also, you know, to prepare people, to prepare populations for the resilience needed, because this is going to be a really, really long war.
Yeah. And so you talked a bit about Russia and this very strange and sort of ahistorical underestimation of them. But I mean, I know that a lot of your work looks at this issue of sort of identity and how nations perceive themselves, but also how others perceive them. What does that say about how we sort of frame Russia? Because anyone who's looked at Russian history would say, well, that they're willing to suffer and fight very long wars and you know, don't write them off. I mean, that's a very facile, but sort of, you know, based on some historical record. But a kind of even a deeper analysis, it seemed to be everyone had just decided in the first few weeks that Russia was a sort of almost a kind of comically bad military force.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the problem was that it was clearly a lot worse than it looked on paper. And bluntly, there were a lot of funny things that happened. I mean, everybody remembers the tractor forces. Like, everybody remembers when the Ukrainian tax authority said they didn't have to pay tax on the tanks that they stole. I mean, there were just lots of funny bits. But ultimately, you know, that was 2 years ago, and it's probably time to stop laughing. In terms of Russia's resilience, is funny because a lot of people often ask me, oh, well, how many people will it take, you know, to die for Russians to turn against the war and all of these sorts of questions. And so because I always find this question slightly frustrating, I thought I'd discuss it with a group of friends who are Ukrainian, in a Ukrainian special division out here. And they said, oh, I can't believe people ask you that. Like, you know, it doesn't make any difference to them. You know, it doesn't matter how many people die. The only thing that would make a difference is if they announced a mobilization of 5 million people and people from Moscow had to go as well. And I actually thought that was a slightly impatient but pretty decent answer on their part. Because, you know, a lot of the people who are dying, first of all, a lot of them are volunteers. Okay, yeah, they're signing up for money, but...
yeah.
I mean, even if somebody offered me a similarly remarkable amount of money, let's say in British terms, as, you know, a $20,000 sign up bonus is for let's say, you know, potential recruits in Russia, I still feel very confident I wouldn't choose to go and commit genocide in a neighboring country. So people feel in Russia that, okay, well, these guys, they know what they're doing. They volunteered to go out there. Well, you know, so they don't have much sympathy for them. I have to say, sitting in Kharkiv, and even if I was sitting in Oxford, I have zero sympathy for them either. And I think there just needs to be some, at the moment, I'm doing a lot of research on the occupied territories and just the sheer numbers of Russians who have moved into the occupied territories. It's staggering. We're talking about 100,000 Russians, at least. That's numbers conservative, in Melitopol alone. And so... lots of Russians are perfectly okay with the war, and the war is not affecting them necessarily in a negative way. And although the death numbers are high, the demography of who is dying, i.e. the poorer people, the people who don't have as much voice, bluntly, the people who, if we can talk of a Russian middle class, the Russian middle class don't really care about, the people who are dying, they're not just the... they are not viewed as important, but also the numbers of those dying ultimately aren't balancing out the number of people who are kind of all right with the war or doing okay out of it. You know, a lot of, there's new elites forming, there's new ways to make money. You know, you can buy, provided you don't mind stepping over the corpses on the threshold of the doorway, you can buy a nice new flat near the sea in Mariupol or Berdyansk. That's where we are. And I think the consistent refusal, one of the things that frustrates me is, as somebody who would like to see a different Russia, if only for Ukraine's sake, is the consistent refusal to engage with the utter moral catastrophe that is happening in Russia.
On that very troubling thought, what I'm just interested, for example, the 100,000 people, the people moving into Melitopol, what is it they want? What, because is it, I mean, life in Melitopol, is it that much different or better to the life that they would have had somewhere else? Or is it just that they're given some sort of small level financial incentive that takes them there?
So there's a few different elements. In general, Russia Russia has really struggled, for example, with the recruitment of teachers for obvious reasons, because Ukrainian citizens don't often want to brainwash the Ukrainian children into whatever historical nonsense is on the Russian curriculum. Russia is in a position where, in principle, I guess, then it has to recruit from Russia. However, it also deliberately chooses to, for example, particularly in sort of the construction or the sort of trade, construction and trade work, they deliberately recruit and at much, much higher salaries than in Russia, from Russia. And they also recruit sort of migrant workers that are in Russia, if that makes sense, who are not necessarily Russian citizens. So there's a financial incentive to it, but because the Russian government provide one, and also because the Russian government, you know, are deliberately trying to alter the ethnic makeup of the regions in order to insist that actually these have always been, you know, these incredibly, you know, multi-ethnic regions, and, you know, Ukrainians are a minority, so therefore Russia definitely has a right. I mean, it's something that Russia has done for centuries. Sitting in Kharkiv 100 years ago, Kharkiv was an almost 100% Ukrainian-speaking city. Now you probably have about 50-50, I suppose. But until 2022, you could have made the argument that it was almost 100, certainly before 2014, it was an almost 100% Russian-speaking city. So, and why did that happen? Because of the Holodomor, which was worse. The worst experiences were in Kharkiv region, and because of, you know, of course, World War II didn't help either, to put it mildly, but then also the sort of resettling of Russia, of Ukrainians into Siberia, other places, and the resettling of Russians and other peoples into Kharkiv. So this constant kind of playing around with the ethnic makeup of places in order to then argue that these places aren't really, you know, they don't really belong to the identity that they've previously for centuries professed. And therefore, in fact, they can be subsumed under, you know, the greater imperialistic Russian identity. It's a pretty common trick, and it's just something that they're doing now in the occupied territories. The other thing to add is that, of course, you know, some of these cities are in very beautiful places. You know, Mariupol is on the sea. Berdyansk is also very close, and so, you know, they have nicer weather. They're just, you know, sort of geographically nicer places, let's say, than Tomsk.
Right.
Nothing against Tomsk, but and you can buy them for much cheaper. There are lots of incentives to encourage you to move there. And in a city like Melitopol that fell very soon after the full scale invasion, there really isn't that much damage to the city either. So
it's as if people have suddenly sort of got an incentive to be able to move to the Mediterranean and not pay anything or pay very little in order to live there.
Yeah, I think so. I guess maybe it's like, I do not want to give anybody on the right wing of the government any ideas, but I guess it's like if Britain invaded the Costa del Sol and then obviously killed all of the Spanish people there, eradicated all of their culture, but then offered incentives to British people to move there.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it does appear in a future manifesto, we'll blame you, Jade, but hopefully people won't take it for that. Let's talk a bit about Ukraine itself. So obviously Ukraine has, as you said, been starved of resources by a series of countries that are, you know, tied up in their own domestic politics. But it's been fighting a fairly kind of desperate battle, particularly in the Donbass, but you know, not uniquely. It's overnight, as we're talking, the US finally ratified its long delayed assistance package. Is that going to be sort of too little? Overnight, there was an assistance package passed in the US, finally, after so much delay and absurd kind of pro-Russian activism by Republicans. But is that going to be too little, too late?
Oh, no, I don't think it's too... Well, I mean, everything is too little, too late when you have to fight the Russian army, I imagine. But no, it will make a big difference. It will turn the war... Currently, the war is one of Ukraine is losing. To put it starkly, and it will change the war back into a war of attrition. And if the Ukrainians use it wisely and are able to deal with certain mobilization or morale issues and a few other issues, and then, you know, they could start to think about, you know, a counteroffensive maybe at the beginning of next year. Because the Russian effort, though so far sustainable, I mean, there are issues, there are weaknesses that as time goes on, you know, will become more evident. And also, of course, Ukraine has been stepping up its attacks on Russia itself, which I think is not only a morally justified approach, but also a strategically intelligent approach.
Yeah, and that's been one of the fascinating things, that in the absence of Western support, you know, Ukraine developing very, very impressive drone technology, but also, you know, operations by people on the ground. And it, do you think that that is that how Ukraine can win this war? Because in a way, what seems very difficult to get one's head around, you talk about 100,000 Russians having now entered the occupied territories. The fact that Russia is currently advancing, and it, even if it was turned round, you know, how would Ukraine be able to regain the territories that have been sort of sliced off?
Well, it's funny, if I come to the first part of your question, it's funny you should ask, because that's exactly what I work on in Ukraine, though I don't always talk about it maybe as publicly as I should, but often that's just because I'm busy. But essentially what I've been doing out here with some friends who are in the army and some friends who've been supplying the Ukrainian army, obviously Ukrainian friends, since 2014, is we've set up a fund that gets money to Ukrainian, basically we've set up a consortium of different people that we know who are currently making weapons, making drones, making software, making electronic warfare, making ammunition here in Ukraine, in different parts, and to help get money to them directly. So just direct supply chains, no, you know, not getting anybody else involved, always the safest and best and most efficient way. So that they can produce more things. And, you know, we regularly go and visit them, you know, at the different factories. You know, they're often just back from the front lines. I remember speaking to one of them. He was just desperately upset. He'd just got back. It was the day after Avdiivka had fallen. He'd just got back from Avdiivka. And he spoke about how, you know, they have these kind of remote control evacuation devices. And you can also put like machine guns on them, but you can also use them to evacuate people. And they had been using them to evacuate people, obviously, in Avdiivka. And he was just so upset, because he was like, if we could make 17 more of these, we could have saved, you know, 112 more people. And he'd obviously sat and like done the maths on the long drive back. And it's sort of comments, and to be honest with you, you know, thousand mile stairs like that, that were part of the reason why we even originally set up this initiative, because Ukraine currently has the capacity across its domestic suppliers to produce double what it's currently producing. And that would make up, you know, a good chunk. You read different figures. We're currently crunching our own data to get something specific. But you read, you know, that could be between 15 to 35% of their actual overall needs, which is significant, you know, and could of course then increase over time. But at the moment, it's only able to produce half of what it's capable of, because it just doesn't have the funding. The funding is just not going to the domestic producers. And a lot of the things that we're talking about, because they're made in Ukraine, because Ukraine is a very kind of make do and mend society, some of the stuff is really, really high tech, particularly, you know, the software. It's really, really interesting. But some of it is just, you know what, this is good enough. And you can buy these things for, you know, $15,000. And I don't know what you could buy at like a military arms fair, a Western military arms fair, for $15,000. But it probably wouldn't even be a ticket to the event.
Probably a couple of helmets and some body armor.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's a sort of the kind of amazing innovation that exists in Ukrainian society. You know, one of the other things that you touched on was Ukraine's own challenges with, mm-hmm. with manpower, with mobilization, and of course morale as well. And it seems that the Russia has taken so much territory, it's quite hard to imagine how Ukraine would be able to regain that in a sort of conventional military manner. Or what's your sense from the people you talk to of that question?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
I think the conventional wisdom, you'll hear different things and you may hear it, you know, because people are pushing different agendas rather than directly answering the question. But I think the conventional wisdom among most kind of people is that if you want to deal with this, you need to take Crimea, because if you take Crimea, then you can quite easily get back Kherson and those parts of Zaporizhia region. And realistically, Luhansk and Donetsk are going to be then, you know, up for negotiation, up for discussion. The Crimea is where it started. Crimea is where it has to end. And so the focus is on retaking Crimea, which is interesting because I think in the Western thinking, it's almost like you have to go almost like back in accordance with when places were taken. So first you should get back Kherson and Zaporizhia, then maybe, you know, Donetsk and Luhansk, and then only then Crimea. Whereas the Ukrainian, the conventional wisdom among people where it's possible to have, you know, an honest conversation about this, is that they have to take back Crimea. And then once they can take back Crimea, then everything's kind of on the table. Because the understanding is that, bluntly, it's a really horrible thing to say, but, you know, Donetsk and Luhansk cities themselves, they are in a very severe demographic decline. There are not many fighting-aged men left there, and that the Russians don't really care about Donetsk and Luhansk. They were a useful tool to undermine Ukraine and Ukrainian statehood until they won. So the thinking is that the Russians will be more, that if having lost Crimea, Russia would be, defeated. And so then one could start talking about negotiations over Donetsk and Luhansk.
That's really interesting. I mean, I, as you say, I've not heard people in the West talk about it in that way. Do you think there's any risk that some of the Western supposed allies will sort of say, "Oh, but Crimea's different," because we've had this sort of, which you know, is a tiresome argument, and they'll try and push the Ukrainians to sort of throw themselves back at the Donbass as they attempted last year.
I think that the West should not underestimate the amount of credibility it's lost in the eyes of Ukrainians over the last year. That was one of the things that was really hard over the last 6 months, was just that constant feeling that even if they didn't want to be, my friends were slightly angry with me just as a representative of the West. Because so many people are dying. So many people are losing limbs. So many people are coming back, you know, without this or that, or damaged. There's just so much pain and suffering. And to many Ukrainians, it just is completely inconceivable why the West wouldn't support them more. Because clearly, particularly in Europe, I mean, it's very obviously in European countries' national interest and security interest to do so. And obviously, it's very hard to find an answer to some of their questions.
Yeah. I mean, what you've just said, it's very hard to find an answer. What do you think is the answer? I mean, I think I was very struck by the way that you've got European countries saying they need to support Ukraine, and they're going to change their economies and they're going to become much better at defence. And then they block Ukrainian agriculture exports, which at the moment is it's a sort of lifeblood of the economy. So it seems to me it's quite hard to see what the hell people think they're doing.
Yeah, it feels, I think it's, look, for a long time, a lot of Western kind of defence rhetoric has been very, very performative. I think we're beyond the purely performative phase now. I think there is, of course, some substance to what is being said, but it just feels it's still nowhere near the level that it needs to be. You know, when you think about what would the impact be, let's say even for Britain, in terms of, you know, what would happen to food prices, what would happen to energy prices if Russia were to succeed, either through total conquest or through being able to force Ukraine into a very unfavorable negotiated settlement. If you think about those things, then I don't see how it isn't in every single British government or indeed future government's interest to start putting out some pretty serious, pretty concrete ideas on what can be done to ensure Ukraine wins rather than we'll be with Ukraine for as long as it takes, because I don't know what that means. And Ukrainians think they know what it means, and they think it means we'll be with you until you bleed out.
Yeah. And it increasingly feels like that. Well, I mean, one of the striking and sort of left field ideas proposed by President Macron was to say that NATO forces, well, in his case, French forces, should be on the ground in Ukraine. Is that something that would has any mileage to it, or is that just sort of Macron being a bit mad?
No, I think it is something that's being discussed seriously. I don't know about actual troops in Ukraine, but certainly troops, let's say, in Poland, close to the border, discussions about a no-fly zone over Western Ukraine. My understanding is that these are serious discussions. And yes, they might be inspired by domestic political needs in some part, but that doesn't make them any less real. The problem is that I think they're being greeted with a fair amount of skepticism here in Ukraine, and it would be interesting to see what the Brits do, because the British are treated with far less skepticism here in Ukraine than the French on these matters. And I think that if you had a sort of Franco-British alliance that had then I think, and also bluntly, the British have been much more closely in contact with Ukraine. They, in the defence sphere, they know how things work. They know how the system works pretty well. So I think then you could start to talk about maybe some actual tangible outcomes. But I certainly think that anything involving a sort of no-fly zone in part of Western Ukraine, that's going to need to be thought about very, 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 very carefully, because I mean, we need to honestly answer the question if British and French pilots are going to shoot down. They're going to shoot down Russian missiles. That's one thing. They're going to shoot down Russian planes, because that I don't like this kind of tendency to think of everything in terms of escalation. But even for me, you know, we need to be honest. I would love to be able to say, let's completely just, you know, let's have a no-fly zone over Kharkiv. I would really, really appreciate that, especially right now, yeah. If only for selfish reasons. But, you know, nobody's going to win from nuclear Armageddon. And whilst that point is consistently overmade, particularly because of Russian nuclear blackmail, we can't completely dismiss it, you know, entirely. And I think that goes from both sides, because I think on the other side, what you get among the people who are very keen to give in to nuclear blackmail is a complete disregarding of how much nuclear proliferation is coming our way if Russia wins, because it will be evidence that you shouldn't give up your nuclear weapons or your capacity to make nuclear weapons, because Ukraine did, and then it got conquered, and the security guarantees that were given were not worth anything. And that countries, if you're a smaller country, you know, being bullied by a larger country, the first thing you're going to do is get nuclear weapons. If I was in that case, I think that it's really, you know, a government's first duty is to protect its people. I imagine there are quite a lot of countries, not just Poland, who are going to be looking to acquire or somehow get nuclear weapons settled on their territory. It's going to lead to a huge nuclear proliferation. And that's only going to make our world more dangerous. So, you know, there's no easy way out of this. I think it's just a time for, you know, for grown-up discussions, for working out what is possible and doing it. You know, it's not a time for reconceptualizing our understanding of, oh, what is the free world? What is this or that, you know?
Yeah, I think that final point is so important, because it seems that there's a lot of people are saying, well, you know, we've got to go back to the drawing board. And you think, well, that can we do that later? Because right now, you know, there's someone needs to win a war.
Yeah, no, it's so true. It's like, look, I love theorizing. Okay, I'm an academic. I love theorizing as much as the next woman, but let's do it, you know, when people, you know, aren't being, you know, shot en masse.
I suppose then hanging over a lot of this are two sort of nightmare scenarios. One is a Trump presidency. I have to admit, you know, this week it feels a bit more distant, partly because of the Ukraine bill having got through, partly because Trump is farting away in a New York courtroom, and that doesn't seem to be doing his electoral prospects much good. But it's still obviously a real risk. And then the other one is that Russia managed to make really substantial gains over the summer, this summer, and it was something that General Budanov, the leader of the Ukraine's military intelligence, spoke about in recent days. So perhaps taking that last one first, what's your feeling about that possibility?
Yeah, I understand. I think, look, it's coming. I think a lot, you know, the offensive is definitely coming. Most people are agreed on that. The imminence of it is where I think some intelligence differs between the West and Ukraine. The targets of it, again, there's some disagreement on that, you know, whether the target would be to take Kharkiv or whether or not it would be to destroy Kharkiv. I tend towards the kind of making, depopulating, making Kharkiv unlivable, element, but you know, there's lots of good intelligence that also could be put together to make an argument that I'm wrong, and I won't pretend to know more than I certainly won't pretend to know more than General Budanov. An offensive is almost certainly coming. It'll be interesting to note what effect the aid package has, because it does seem that within and around Putin, this was slightly unexpected. They did expect this to continue for some time. And so what we've seen in recent days, certainly here in Kharkiv, is, you know, a real stepping up in the number of attacks, obviously before the aid arrives or starts to actually sort of come in. In terms of the offensive, I would imagine the main focus will continue to be, as it has been for some time, Russia's strategic aim of taking, you know, the up to the administrative borders of Luhansk and Donetsk regions. So we know that the situation in Chasiv Yar is very bad. The situation, you know, going towards the directions of Pokrovsk and of Konstantinivka is also looking a little bit less, a lot shakier than it was. So there's lots. That's where I would imagine. The main thrust will be that certainly where the main bulk of men are being gathered, but yeah, something is clearly also going to happen in the Sumy Kharkiv directions. Exactly what that is, I'm not sure. The success of it, I'm a little bit more skeptical of, because what we've seen is, despite Russia having this huge advantage, I mean, their artillery advantage has been, you know, around like between 7 to 10 to 1, they've really struggled to actually, until the last few days, to actually make much, to make any kind of major advances, despite firing men and, you know, much greater amounts of weaponry. And I think there is still a number of issues. We should never underestimate the Russians, but we also, you know, in turn, shouldn't overcorrect to then overestimate them. I think, you know, there are real issues, you know, with Russian, with the way that Russia is fighting this war, that makes it. Certainly, I can't conceive of how they would take a city like Kharkiv. Will they make further gains? Very, very possibly, yes. Will they be huge sweeping gains? Oh, first of all, I really, really, really hope not, because a good chunk of my friends will be on the execution lists if they do. But I also don't think that it's likely. And speaking to soldiers who are responsible for defending this city, they are also very, very dismissive of the idea that the Russians would ever be able to take this city. So that gives me some hope.
I mean, I suppose that Russia's model has hitherto been to destroy cities rather than take them.
Yeah, and they'll give it a good go of Kharkiv, which would be why it'd be lovely if the Western allies could get some air defense here, because there are no Patriot systems here.
But
It would be.
they've got them in Spain, so that's good.
Yeah, well, to be fair, you can't, you know, you can't trust the Portuguese. They'll always try and invade you.
Yeah. Yes, well, I mean, history bears that out, but maybe not terribly recently. Moving on to the other nightmare scenario, which is a Trump presidency, because in a way, you know, Ukraine certainly can't win this war by November, and then America hands victory to Russia anyway.
I think, in a way, it's interesting, Trump, because one of the things that I found really it'd be interesting to see if it's changed now the aid package has been passed, but certainly last week I had a lot of conversations about, you know, the US, and a lot of people said to me, okay, well, actually, I don't know if Trump will be any worse. And I was like, what do you mean? They said, well, you know, Biden, he just drip feeds the support, essentially. He obviously doesn't want Ukraine to win. And, you know, Trump, yeah, of course, he's completely unpredictable, but Putin's not going to agree to any of his, you know, negotiation terms. And then he'll get, you know, maybe he'll get upset and want to support us instead. And I was like, well, I mean, that is possible. Trump is unpredictable.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't, I guess their feeling was, we know what we're going to get with Biden and it won't be enough for us to win. At least with Trump, we don't know. It could go either way. And I don't have any comments on whether or not their analysis is correct or incorrect, but I did find it quite striking that so many people essentially seem to share a version of this opinion. Clearly, for me, I think it's better to stick with the devil you know, if I can put it that way. And that's not just for reasons of Ukraine, of course, though I appreciate why Ukraine is, of course, the main focus for Ukrainians. But I think really the issue comes down to who is this, you know, a potentially existential security issue for? And ultimately, it's a really big problem, and it's definitely in America's interest to support Ukraine, but it's Europe's existential or potential existential security issue. And we really do need to step up, and, you know, much less of this, oh, we're on a war footing now, so we're going to pretend to increase our defense spending, but actually just put in some random bits from different budgets to 2.5% by 2030. I mean, okay, good. So what will we say? You know, sorry, Russia, could you just, now you've conquered Ukraine, could you just hold off from invading the Baltics? Because we've still got 2 years.
Ready yet.
Or we've got the budget. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, on Biden, actually, I've certainly wondered for some time whether that his policy is not that Ukraine wins, but that Ukraine bleeds Russia, well, ties Russia down, and so prevents Russia from being a geopolitical actor in other arenas, because it's got very sucked into Ukraine. And clearly, with this now with this aid package, there's this sort of sense, oh, the Americans are back and it's great news. But actually, if you look at their position on the F-16s, on the equivalent of Storm Shadow, on a whole set of on you know, NATO's relationship with Ukraine or Ukraine's potential membership aspirations, all those sorts of things, you know, the Biden administration has been pretty conservative, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has, along with, you know, the German approach. So the Germans have given lots and lots of money, as of course have the Americans. But I think really what we're talking about are differing conceptualizations of the war and of potential end states and what might be desirable potential end states. And I think that ultimately the US, as was the case, you know, with the collapse of the USSR, is very, very hesitant to see the defeat of Russia, because it thinks that that could lead to the collapse of Russia, and then you have, you know, different warlords going around with nuclear weapons. I mean, that didn't happen with the case of in the case of the collapse of the USSR. And ultimately, I mean, at some point, you know, you do hear this these conversations of, okay, but what about if it gets much worse? And you sometimes think, I mean, okay, but it's quite bad already. You know, and again, these discussions about escalation, it's like, sitting here really feels like the situation has already escalated somewhat. So clearly, whatever we've been doing previously, basically hampering Ukraine's ability to defend itself, or almost insisting that it doesn't, you know, if we go back to 2014 and Crimea, etc., that's not been working, has it? So I'm not saying that means we go completely in the opposite direction, But we need to therefore start thinking of, okay, well, you know, what could work? And also, Russia could collapse anyway, regardless of us. At some point, Putin is going to die, and there's no proper system of succession in place. It's going to be an incredibly destabilizing period. I think the much better thing to do than to think about, oh, what might Russia do, is to think, how can we best protect ourselves from Russia?
Yeah.
How can we best make ourselves as impervious to the various threats that emanate from Russia, the various dangers and risks, as possible? That seems to me to be a much wiser system of operating than constantly trying to imagine all of these different scenarios where, bluntly, you know, there's very little evidence for any scenario that looks in any way even vaguely positive happening in Russia in the near future. So I really hope I'm proven wrong on that, but I don't see any evidence for it. So.
Well, I think, and obviously the killing of Navalny, not that he was necessarily the solution, but it's an indicator of how completely crushed any kind of opposition has become inside Russia.
Exactly. And so many of the people who were opposition as well have left for completely understandable reasons. But, you know, I mean, who remains? And ultimately, I mean, Putin, this war's been going on for 10 years. You know, there were no members of the elite who stood up and resigned after the annexation of Crimea. Like, I just don't see where any kind of alternative power base is going to come, except potentially, you know, from perhaps, you know, those who fought in the war in Ukraine, or those, but even still then the military generally doesn't get involved in politics in Russian history. So I'm really genuinely at a loss to say exactly how I think that Russia will continue once Putin, as in how Russia will then develop or evolve, how the political system, the social system will evolve after Putin dies. But I don't think he's going out of power until he dies. But the sheer unpredictability of it, I think, suggests that we should be putting in place measures again to protect ourselves, rather than constantly thinking, oh, you know, or having these discussions, how can we bring, you know, Russia back into European security? How can we? I mean, we don't really have these conversations about China, you know, on the same level. You know, what about if Russia is not able to be a cohesive part of European security, and us managing European security means limiting Russia's access or ability to influence our security? What about that?
Yeah, well, I think it's unanswerable. Just in the final few minutes we've got left, tell us what your own plans are. You're in Kharkiv for a while. You're going and coming. Are you publishing a new book, or is what's this work sort of leading to?
Mm-hmm. So one is an ongoing project on the occupied territory. So I spend a lot of time here in the deoccupied territories trying to understand what Russia is doing, because I feel like it's a really important part of, you know, of Russian society that is in the occupied territories that is not being analysed or factored in. And the other part is, as I said, working on this Free Ukraine Fund. Essentially, there's two parts of it. One is a research part. We call it unconventional statecraft, trying to bring together all of the informal, i.e. not government, actors around, particularly sort of the UK, US and Scandinavia, who are providing aid, military aid, security assistance, let's say, to the Ukrainian army, to try to, I suppose, emphasize that, yeah, autocracies, they have command economies or different measures that give them benefits and advantages during war, but democracies also have an advantage that they give their citizens the agency and freedom to organize and act. And we've seen that in incredible numbers during Russia's full-scale war against Ukraine. And we just want to try to keep that as horizontal as possible, but just to coordinate it so there's, you know, a better network. So that's one side of it. And then the other side of it is, again, just getting those donations to Ukrainian manufacturers who are, you know, working straight into the front lines.
Well, it's fantastic work. I wish you every possible success, and obviously I hope that you stay safe in what is currently a target of Russian bombing and artillery and so on. And thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Lines. If you want to know more about the work that Jade is doing and the fund that she is involved with, I've put links to that in the show notes and also to her social media so you can follow her work. Behind the Lines, as ever, is presented and produced by me, Arthur Stone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.